There's still a few people coming in, so I think we'll start in a few minutes.
Bien, bonsoir, mesdames et messieurs. Good evening, everyone. C'est un plaisir de vous revoir ici pour la deuxième soirée publique du Goodman Cancer Center. The second evening that we have this year is very much towards one very specific topic that we want to discuss, and that it's very at the heart of what clinical treatment, not only in oncology, but many different fields of medicine is going, which is personalized medicine. So we have three wonderful speakers tonight. Ken Dewar, which is the, I'll present them one by one when they speak, which is now the interim director of the Genome Center. But Ken is a geneticist that has made quite a lot of outstanding development and discovery, particularly we may remember the C. difficile problem in our hospital. The team of Ken sequenced that bacteria and was able to identify which one were in each hospital. You may discuss that a bit if you ask him questions, but that's not the topic tonight, but just to tell you that. We have also Dr. Morag Park. Morag is the director of the Institut du Cancer, des Instituts de Recherche en Santé du Canada. She's the head of all the Cancer Institute research at the CRHR. But also a colleague at the Cancer Center. She has published wonderful papers also on genes and how tumors can be differentiated by different genes. Also, the environment of the tumor, can we predict the outcome looking at the gene profile of the tumors and also the patient? So I think she'll give us after Ken explain to us what the technology is all about and what DNA is all about, just to remind us a bit, Morag will tell exactly where we're going with these genes, how we can profile, and what is, in fact, personalized medicine. And finally, Mark Tikovits is a clinician, PhD at the Jewish General Hospital, works on breast cancer mainly, Mark. And Mark will tell us a bit on the clinic, so what's happened. So when we go to the clinic today, what is the tool that clinicians use to in personalized medicine to decide which treatment you will have and which one you should not have? I think I'll let you decide that. But, of course, my job, my name is Michel Tremblay. I'm the director of the Goodman Cancer Center. Et une chose que je fais, je dois faire, c'est un peu donner un peu de problème à ces trois speakers-là, give them a bit of trouble by raising a few issues. And the first one, when we talk about personalized medicine, so first I want to say I thank you for all for being here. And this is the Roslyn and Maurice Goodman Cancer Research Center public lectures. And again, we had a full series last year. We have four series this year. We have another one coming on stem cells. And the last one, this is I'm going to say that here too. Oh. Yeah, I think I'm having it there, but it was supposed to show up, but you have it there. So the first session we had was on how to catch cancer. We had a nice evening discussing, nice for those which care about viruses, that's not so nice. But at least we discussed this issue of can some viruses give cancer. It was a very nice evening where I debated quite a lot, including vaccine. The one which is coming, I think I'm going to have to take this off just to show it to you, because imaging is not working on. So on March 24th in 2011, we will talk about stem cells and cancer. So friends or foes, are they the cancer stem cells that are not curable and that's what they're coming back in the recurrence of cancer? Or we can use stem cells or as a way to better treat people. And tonight is new approach in cancer management. Personalized cancer treatment, facts or fiction in terms of personalized medicine. So now I'm going to go back to my completely screw-up slide now. Hopefully this will be okay. But no, it will not be okay if I do that. So I'm going to stay here, put it back here. And the last evening of I'll put Mara right there in her little box. She'll be very happy with that. Okay, so this last evening, we'll be talking about cancer survivorship. It will be a very special evening. Many of you may know Marla Shapiro. She has her own show on CTV talking about health. She's a graduate from McGill and a cancer survivor too. So I think it'll be a very nice evening to discuss all aspects of this psychosocial and how, in fact, survivors deal with their cancer and families, including on that. So now I'm going to try to get back into this slide. There you go. Personalized medicine. The first thing, what is personalized medicine? Well, for many of you, and I think my mom, in my days, though, this gentleman on the left was speaking French. You may have recognized. Who recognized him? Who is? Marcus Welby, the best physician you can get. And what does Marcus Welby do? Well, Marcus Welby does the right treatment at the right dose for the right patients at the right time and the right outcome. So that's what we want from Marcus. And really, that's the same story we're going to hear tonight about personalized medicine. So hopefully our three speakers will get there. So what's new beside personalized medicine? If we have a physician talking to us on one-on-one, does genetics improve or not? But there's other issues on personalized medicine. Some are a bit more scientific, and I'll present some for you. The Zenger Institute that Ken knows very well is an institute that sequenced a lot of cancer genome. And if you look this afternoon at the number of mutations they found in cancers, they found 138,000 different mutations existing in cancer. So that's a lot of mutations to follow up as a clinician. And this involves over 18,647 genes. So again, that's a bit complex. And I'm hoping that you guys will be able to answer that. How do we discriminate with all those mutations? There's also, if you add to this, in the clinical pipeline, over 1,200 different drugs in cancer. So you look at the combinations, it's immensely complicated. And again, hopefully we have some answers, probably not all of them, this evening. So this is a bit the field of pharmacogenomics, which is a bit what we're talking today also. So personalized medicine in terms of diagnosis, prognosis, but also in terms of treatment. And I think this is really much intertwined between the two. Quel médicament, avec quel gène que l'on a, chaque personne a des gènes différents. Donc, c'est un peu compliqué de trouver toutes ces façons de traiter et d'aller dans cette médecine personnalisée. There's also another issue that more and more we see. I had a little small movie, but we are a bit late, so I'm not going to show it to you. But this is a website from a company that sells genetic tests in cancer for reproductive purposes, for blood disorders. You go to the pharmacy, and you can buy your little kit in the U.S. and do your genetic test on yourself at home. The movie I had is, in fact, a very funny movie, but it's not funny when you think about it, but it's a gentleman which walks with his little daughter and his wife, and you have somebody from the company behind says, do you know if this is your child or not, you know? So, so this guy goes to the pharmacy, buy a kit for paternity, and happily his wife and him are testing their child, right? I'm sure the wife is not so happy that he wants to test his child. Anyway, there's something very bizarre with this movie. The point is that, again, we're going into that direction, so perhaps many of the genetic tests could be done in the hospital, for sure. But they're all those type of commercial purposes where genes and kits are coming up near our pharmacy nearby. So, and of course, we control or not. There's a little cartoon saying that apparently our AP, I don't know what this a computer, is giving our customers unprecedented control over their own lives and allowing them to seize control of their destinies. So please shut it down. So is also clinician happy that we know about all these genes? I don't want to put the border too high now for Mark to take. However, there's two things. Of course, so thinking about this, Walgreens is one of the pharmacies you can buy these kits in the U.S. So if you're now very romantic, or your future wife or husband, would you give your genetic test as a proof of your well-behaved? And the last thing is more scientific, this one. The Time magazine had an issue about, I think it's about a year ago, where they looked at epigenomics. And we're probably not going to touch about that today. But epigenomic means that genes are influenced by environment. So is that true that the gene that we test by these kits will also be reflecting really what is in our genes with the environment or not? So it's a big issue, but again, to show you that there are quite a lot of diversity in genetics. Last thing is, and this is why I think you should be concerned, or not, of course, by the health use of this, but also our government, and Marag is part of the government a little bit. So we're going to pay a lot of money in our taxes for personalized medicine. I hope we'll have some answers also to be convinced that this is the right way to go, and I think they will do that. So without further ado, I will then introduce, I introduced Ken already. Ken will start, and this is my last slide, so I'm not going to keep it there, but I'll give the first slide to Ken. So Ken, thank you for coming tonight. Very appreciated, and you have the crowd for yourself.
So thank you very much, Michelle, and thank you, everyone, for the chance to come and talk to you a little bit and try to give you a sense of the excitement in our field. My talk's not about cancer per se. It's about some of the things that underlie cancer research as well as genomics research sort of throughout the life sciences. And so I think probably you should just think of me as the warm-up act. And maybe to put it in context, perhaps maybe a grunge garage band warming up for the symphonic orchestra. So what I'd like to talk about is a couple of concepts about, you know, why are we interested in this DNA stuff to begin with? And the core concept that I'd like to give you right from the beginning is DNA as a memory molecule. And I'm sorry the slide's a little bit shifted and you can't see it. And I'd like to start before talking about DNA, just, half of a human body here on the picture. And even with the upper half blocked out, there's certain things that you immediately recognize. First, it's a human body. the human body has some element of directionality, and so what we're seeing is the bottom part of the body where the feet and the legs belong. And you can infer from that that there's going to be details about the top of the body. There's a head and some arms and eyes and ears and a nose. But you can't infer a lot more detail than that. And some of you might recognize who this person is, but most of it, and me when I first look at it, there's no way that I can tell what the face looks like, for example. However, if we cut it the other way, it becomes evidently clear. We're looking at Michael Jackson. And whether or not we recognize that this is Michael Jackson, because the human body has bilateral symmetry, the information presented to us on the one half is enough information for us to define the characteristics of the other half that we cannot see. So I don't have to take away the block to show you what the other half of Michael Jackson looks like. You know that just from the information already presented. In some ways, DNA is like that.
Can I just say something? Now we see people passing just little things. This is to take questions. If you have some idea about questions when Ken speak or the other speakers, write it down. At the end, we'll have a table and a round, and I'll get the question from you, and I'll be able to ask him. So sorry about that.
Okay. So did that count against my 20 minutes?
Yeah, you can have another round.
So anyway, so here's a cartoon of a fragment of DNA. We've all heard about DNA being double-stranded in this helical structure. DNA is composed of four building blocks, which, because we aren't very smart ourselves, the researchers, we just call them A, C, G, and T to make our lives simpler. But sort of like the picture of Michael Jackson, there's an element of directionality. We don't really think of top and bottom, but we do think of start and end. And there's an element of symmetry. So if we take this coil and untangle it so it looks more like a ladder, and then chop away half of that ladder so we're presented with half of the information, that half of the information we can use because it defines the rest of the information. So sort of like the picture of Michael Jackson, presented with this information, I cannot tell you anything about what follows this fragment or what precedes this fragment, but the information contained on one strand defines the information on the other strand. So there's a couple fundamental parts of this. Again, coming back to DNA as a memory molecule, this fact that one half can act as a template to define the information on the other half is what allows the passage of information, whether that's at a process level of DNA being used to code the RNA being transcribed for gene expression function, whether that's cells dividing so the information is being passed to all of the cells in the body, or in inheritance, how information is being passed from one generation to another. The world that I live in, there's also two other aspects of this that we take advantage of. One is that in a molecular biology sense, an experimental sense, we can take advantage of the fact that a fragment of DNA, just one of the strands, defines the sequence of the other strand. So even though we can't see the DNA that we might be working with, the fragment, we can do DNA sequencing by marking the bases that come on and following the addition of those bases to determine the DNA sequence. The other aspect is that computationally, we can define the first order structure of DNA as a simple text string of contiguous characters, okay, which then makes a lot of the bioinformatics types analysis simplified. So let me go to sort of another core concept that I want to cover. My wife's name is Alice. She's not here tonight, which is likely going to be a good thing. And like a lot of married couples, we've developed a partnership. And for us, it works on sort of this tandem nature that essentially I recognize her strengths and she recognizes my weaknesses. And in the kitchen, it works sort of like this. My role is essentially to take the shopping list and go out and get things. And she takes a lot of care. She draws little pictures so that if I'm having trouble reading, I still know what I'm supposed to get. But her role is very different. And this is actually what happens when your mother-in-law helps you prepare your talk. So more, Alice's role in the kitchen is a much higher order level than my role. I'm concerned about getting the correct ingredients, but her level has at least two other facets that are way beyond my skill set. First, when she's working at the level of a recipe, she's concerned with things like dosages, how much of this, how much of that, a cup, a tablespoon, a teaspoon, a peck, a bushel, whatever. And also concerned with interactions, mix together, pour, add, bake, do this, do that. And when we're talking about genomics, there's some level of the same thing. We can decode the linear order of the bases in the genome or in a fragment of DNA. We can start to discern that ingredient list of what are the genes. But what we're really struggling with, and where we're getting headway from the types of work the other speakers are doing, is starting to get a deeper understanding about what are the hidden messages, what are the recipes, and how does it all operate. The other part, from a bioinformatics point of view, I'd like to just introduce the idea of knowledge versus understanding and presentation of information. This, if you look at it, this is actually a perfectly correct and perfectly spelled grammatical thing in English. But if you look at the way it's presented, it's very hard to read. You can stare at it and you might see certain words, space, accomplish, whatever in there. But to look at that and discern the message is quite difficult. Without changing the information at all, but just how it's presented, things start to become a little clearer. You can see a lot of things, tab, space, line break, whatever, all in capitals. In a sense, those are structural elements of the message. And then you can see other things that are words, accomplish, month, learned, whatever, interspersed in there. But it's still difficult to read. Same thing, just representing the exact same data, but in a format that we're more familiar with, the message becomes much clearer. And if you'll permit me, I'll just read it quickly. He did not accomplish it in a day or in a week or in a month or in a year, but slowly, very slowly, he learned after he grasped possibilities which lay in those little bugs, so that by the time he was 15, he knew the various combinations which stood for every picture figure in the primer and one or two of the picture books. Of the meaning and use of the articles and conjunctions, verbs and adverbs and pronouns, he had but the faintest conception. So for anyone who doesn't recognize it, this is a quote from the book Tarzan of the Apes. And this is, they're few and far between, but a genius boy raised by apes teaching himself how to read. And in a sense, this is where I am in genomics. I identify with Tarzan. I'm starting to figure out the little squiggles and dots, but again, in the sense of the recipe, the meaning and the use and all of the regulation of that information in the human body and the development is still one of the largest challenges. Okay, so let's go back to real DNA. It's not real DNA, it's just text. But it is a representation of real DNA. And again, as I mentioned, it's just a string of characters. And on this slide, there are 7,231 letters, all of the ACGT variety. Again, because the symmetrical reverse complement nature of DNA, those 700 or 7,000 plus nucleotides define what the corresponding matching nucleotide would be. So we can talk about it as a nucleotide or as base pairs. And then the 7,000 characters fill up the screen. And I wouldn't want to read it, and I'm sure you don't. But to put it in context, as Michelle mentioned, I work on Clostridium difficile. The bacteria, the hospital bacterium, its genome size is 4 million base pairs, which in the context of this slide would be 555 slides. I did want to show you all of them, but Michelle said no. So I'll just show you this one. But then bacteria have small genomes. Our own genome, the human genome, is 3.2 billion base pairs, give or take. And again, if I can't get by with the 555 slides, he's not going to let me do the 450,000, and I didn't want to print them all out. So, taking a step back, in the world I live in, I'd like to give you the 3-minute course on how to sequence DNA. And after 3 minutes, you'll all probably know just as much as I do. The way we start, we take cells that have complete genomes, okay? We take a whole population of those cells, each of those cells which have the same genome. So we have multiple copies of the genome. And we put them through a physical shearing process. So we just chop them up into little bits. We want it to be physical, so essentially the chopping into bits is random, and this just makes it easier for our molecular biology techniques, so we can use little tricks to take each one of those bits and use it as a start for a sequencing reaction, which in there is just highlighted in yellow. And the whole idea being, if the little bits that we've cut up are all random, then we're generating sequence that's randomly distributed against the genome. So as we're obtaining these sequence reads back, we can be thinking about that genome and using the aggregate data and trying to do clever tricks and so on to fill it back in and reconstitute what the genome sequence actually is. So my colleagues and I, nerds that we are, get very excited and talk to each other about how often we should cut these things, how big or how small these fragments should be, if we can get our individual sequence reads a little bit longer, if we do more and it costs more, do we get better results? But the whole idea is to try and take these things to reconstitute the original sequence. So when you think about that, it's a pretty ugly system, and you got to wonder about how smart we really are. Because we've taken a perfectly good genome, we've chopped it into tiny bits, we sequence a tiny bit of those tiny bits, and then we spend all our time trying to put it back together. So if the genome is Humpty Dumpty, then the best I can say is I'm sort of one of the king's men. As I was thinking about the talk, it struck me that we're approaching quite soon the 10-year anniversary of the publications of the first sequencing of the human genome. And I was very lucky. I worked in Boston at the time. I was in one of the labs that was heavily involved in the project. And it was a landmark project in not just genomics, but biology. And a lot of people compared that to biology's version of sending a man to the moon. So where are we 10 years later? Well, 10 years later, we don't think about the human genome and the reference and the map of life and all of that. We're thinking about being able to sequence any genome or perhaps every genome. And as Michelle alluded to, as the personalized medicine or personalized genomics, the health idea behind it, being able to tailor the treatment to the genetic background of the patient who needs that treatment. So if you'll bear with me, because it's a little bit of a stretch, but if the first genome was a trip to the moon, then perhaps the personalized medicine and individual genome sequencing is more like a trip to Mars. So how are we going to get there? Thinking about, again, the technology that we used 10 years ago, or to preface it, it's a technology question. The technology that we used, and there's a picture of the instrument towards the top. It looks like a refrigerator, which is really sad because the technology that we use today looks even more like a refrigerator. And it's really sad that we bring people through the lab and they just say, you've got a lot of refrigerators. But some really special things have happened. To sequence one human genome with the technology of 10 years ago, it's essentially 500,000 experiments and 200 years of machine time. So if you had one machine, you'd have to run it for 200 years, 7 days a week, multiple times a day, et cetera, et cetera. Where we are now, with a lot of advances in miniaturization and massive parallelization, is rough and tough, that same product can be generated in one experiment in less than 1 week for a fraction of the cost. And it's still expensive, but it's a fraction of the cost of what it was. Blah. So show and tell, the original machine shown on top used to work on this kind of sequencing plate, 100 reactions at a time. And most of you can see sort of roughly the size. Over the 10 years, we've gone through several iterations. We went through one where, you know, compared to this plate, we're using a sequencing chip about this size. And on this, we were running about 1 million sequencing reactions in parallel. I don't have three hands, so I'm going to have to ask my lovely assistant.
It's me.
So, you know, there, I mean, Michelle is holding up something that's smaller than a microscope slide.
And he looks down here with me.
There you go. And on this one, with the current technology, we're actually running about 500 million reactions in parallel. And so, again, this is totally changed the way the technology works and is totally changing how people think in scientific experimental design, how they can use these technologies. And it's completely unfair, but just for fun, if, going back to our trip to Mars analogy, if we had a 10,000-fold increase in our ability to travel to Mars, instead of taking 4 months, we'd be in Mars in less than 2 seconds. Okay? And so this has changed our lives dramatically. The thing I won't talk about, other than to show the slide, is there is a partner technology that has advanced just as rapidly, and that's computational sciences. The picture that I'm showing is not the computer in our lab. We have a slightly more updated one. And this is actually something you can find on the internet. It's quite funny to read about a 1950s imagination of what a home computer would look like in the year 2004. And as best as I can tell, the steering wheel does what the mouse does now. Okay. So now, how do people use these advances of the technologies to make advances in the science, which is the real reason we're here? And this is the hard challenge. This gets back to the idea about understanding versus knowledge, the recipes versus the parts list, etc. And the way we phrase the question is trying to find out what are the functional consequences of genetic variation. And we approach this in I think, two dimensions. Sort of on one axis, we can look at things at different levels. We can look at the level of the DNA itself, what is the genetic variation between this person and that person. We can look at some of the epigenomics types factors that Michelle talked about. When is the DNA accessible and when is it not accessible? We can look at RNA level for gene expression and gene regulation. And we can look at the protein level for expression and regulation as well. Where things are rapidly changing is on this other dimension. Because when we sequenced the human genome 10 years ago, we thought, that's it, that's all. Right? We've done it. There's never going to be that amount of money. We've got to live with what we got. But now with the capacities, we can start thinking about not just sequencing multiple genomes, but sequencing genomes or products of genomes in multiple contexts. So as examples, a spatial context, we could be looking at gene expression, gene regulation at the level of the cell or the tissue or the organ. And we can also be looking at things in a time context. Overdevelopment or response to a perturbation or a treatment or an intervention. And so sort of what does that look like or how do we present some of that data and how do we deal with some of that data? So just in the last couple minutes, the cartoon here, sort of the black and gray thing that you... Whoops, that's not what I wanted to do. That you're looking at the top is a representation of a chromosome, human chromosome 4, I believe. And telomere at one end, telomere at the other end, the little sort of reddish two triangles pointing to each other represents the centromere. And there's that little red spot in the middle, which is essentially the area that we're going to zoom into and try and look what's happening in the genome at that spot. and what we can, the types of things we have in our toolbox that we can use for our scientific experiments. So again, building from the last slide, we can sequence RNA both to identify genes and to monitor gene expression levels and changes in expression levels. We can go back and say, okay, we're working on the human genome. We want to sequence other human genomes or sequencing things that are very close to us with the idea that it will be the differences between those similar things that will be important and will give us clues of what to look into next. We can do the flip side of that and sequence things that are very different, like fish and frogs and nematodes and flies. And there's the reverse thing. Look at what's very similar in those very distant relatives to try and point out regions of the genome that are important or perhaps important. We can sequence DNA that's been interacting with proteins, again, to get information on the context of the DNA. Is it available? Is it hidden? Is it transiently being modified in some way? And we can also begin to do the same thing with protein data for protein expression. And this is a little bit more complicated because in many ways we just take our genome and make it into a virtual protein, compare it to the protein data, and then reconfigure it back on what were the coordinates on the original genome. But you can see we're building a fairly complex and comprehensive toolkit. And again, the point that I want to drive home is with the capacities, we can be doing all of these different looks into the genome and the dynamics of the genome at the same time on the same sample. Why do we want to do that? So you can start to look for correlations and say, okay, this that I'm seeing is associated with this other thing, and then is that a hint that this polymorphism might be related to this regulatory factor or whatever. The other part of it is, you know, real estate agents talk about location, location, location. I think for us, we talk about compare, compare, compare. And again, these ideas, and this is just a very short list. It can be much longer with that. But being able to go and take genomics back into what we call hypothesis-driven research, where I want this information from this genome and I want the information from this specific thing, because by comparing and contrasting them, I think I'm going to learn about this. Okay, and so lots of studies about healthy versus disease, early versus late, treated versus non-treated, and again, those spatial and temporal contexts as well. So I'm not going to go much beyond that because I think the other two speakers will cover it a lot better than I could. But I think as a summary, just to sort of go over a couple things. Technologically, we're getting very good at this DNA sequencing stuff. Unfortunately, it's written in a language that we don't understand. And I think as you see the next speakers, you'll see that we are making progress. And then the point that I want to leave you with, while the other speakers are talking about cancers in particular, these revolutions and these inroads are making, you know, not just throughout all other aspects of human health research, but throughout the life sciences as well. So thank you very much.
I think we'll take the questions after. If you don't mind, since we started with a lot of people, we're a bit late, we'll take the questions all at the end. You can write them on your paper, and I think this would be a fantastic way to win. No, but I think you can do this. If you don't click, you can. Okay. And the next speaker is Morag Park, and will tell us a bit all the nice technology that can and the science that was developed, what we can do with it, and what is personalized medicine.
Well, maybe I have to learn to spell first. There you go. That's what happens when you don't have your glasses on. Anyway, I'm very happy to be here tonight. I actually chose, although Michelle said that I would talk about the work that's going on in my lab, I actually chose to sort of give a snapshot of what's happened in my life in science for the last 20-odd years. And I think what's very exciting about that is that's what's led us to the stage where we can say we're using personalized medicine. Now, we have to be careful with that term because I think any clinician in the room would say that they've always strived to treat patients in a personal way. So they always want to treat you for your disease. But I we are now building a really an understanding of what a more personalized medicine could be. I'm actually on a working group with Health Canada at the moment. So the government is aware of this. The government needs to address this. Michelle said this is going to cost us a lot of tax dollars. Well, I think most of you will probably be aware that we already spend about 50% of our GMP on healthcare costs. The hope would be in the long term that we may become sufficiently sophisticated that we treat individuals in a much better manner so it actually saves the healthcare system money. But likely, to begin with, it will cost us more money. However, if we want to think, what is personalized medicine? So the goal is that it refers to the tailoring of preventative, diagnostic, or therapeutic interventions. I would say we're not yet quite at the stage of prevention. We may be for diabetes. We could screen, perhaps, for those of you carrying mutations that would predispose you to diabetes. We're getting much better, though, at the stage of diagnosis. We're getting tools to diagnose disease, particularly cancers, in a more efficient manner. We're also beginning to understand the changes that happen in these cancers, and by knowing this and having tests that allow us to identify these in the clinic, we can then tailor the treatment to an intervention. It really doesn't mean, at this stage, the creation of health interventions that are targeted directly to an individual. Although Michelle said you can send your DNA away, or cells from your cheek, for example, to companies in the United States and get your DNA sequence back, at this stage, it's maybe not so much use for you. We're not at the stage where we can really target each one of you individually. Maybe in 20 years we'll be there. But really what we're thinking about is, if we're talking about disease, to understand the disease and to hopefully target the disease state in a much more personalized manner. Not good with reading. But the goal is to really, so the hope with these tools is that this can allow for earlier and or targeted interventions to improve health outcomes. So what is personalized medicine? So the goal is to develop drugs on the basis of individual genetic differences, but this may be changes within, for example, a tumor. So we want to target those changes that cause that tumor. And I'll give you some examples where we've really made some successes. How would it work? So the goal is to tailor therapies to genetically similar subpopulations. So what I'll give you some examples about breast cancer. Breast cancer can be broken down into different subtypes. You would like to target each of those subtypes in the correct manner, and that would be different for a different subtype. What is it based upon? It's based on what Ken gave us a very nice example on, understanding the changes in the DNA. It's called pharmacogenomics. It's the pharmacology and understanding genetics. And really the two together allow us to tailor the treatments to target the disease. So some of the goals in personalized medicine, and you know, Ken gave us an example, is to really understand, for example, people that would be responders or non-responders to a particular drug. But also to understand if some people would have adverse effects to a particular drug. And this is particularly caused by often what we call polymorphism, so changes in our DNA were normal, but we actually metabolize different drugs differently. This is actually true for warfarin. Many individuals, particularly our aging society, may be taking warfarin, and some of us metabolize that drug in a more efficient manner than others. So there's now tests that would allow us to identify who these individuals are. The goal would be to have these little biochips, so that rather than have to have these tests done in a big clinical lab, we'll have some very simple little chips, just like the pregnancy tests that some of you may use or have used, so that this would become something simple and easy to use. The goal in identifying these changes is as I said, for improved patient care. So the hope would be that we can use biomarkers or genetic tests for diagnosis of acute or chronic syndromes, for risk stratification, to select the correct therapy to treat the disease, and to monitor response to therapy. This is perhaps as important as getting the correct therapy. Are you truly responding to that therapy? And obviously for early detection of subclinical disease. To be honest, for most of us, particularly from the point of view of cancer, if we could detect that cancer early enough and understand the changes that have occurred, it's much more amenable to treat the cancer. So if we go back to this example about breast cancer, the old paradigm really in the pre-genomic era was that breast cancer was of two types. And I think Mark may talk a little bit about that, I don't know. There was breast cancer that we knew was estrogen receptor positive, and breast cancer that we knew was estrogen receptor negative. Now, these types of tests have been done for more than 10 years. This used to be a biochemical test. Now it's a test that's actually done in the pathology labs. But this allows a decision to be made to treat the patients. If you're a patient who has breast cancer that's estrogen receptor positive, you would be treated usually with tamoxifen. This is an anti-estrogen. It blocks the activity of the estrogen receptor. And from research that's been conducted in the lab, we know that the estrogen receptor promotes the proliferation of these tumor cells that are estrogen receptor positive. This is not exactly personalized medicine because in these tumors, the estrogen receptor doesn't cause the cancer, but it's actually important for that cancer to keep dividing, to grow and get bigger. So these would be some of the earliest types of personalized or more personalized medicine for breast cancer. We've now entered really a paradigm shift. This is based both on new technologies in sequencing, but also new advances in molecular pathology. And the paradigm shift tells us that breast cancer is not one disease. So we've got what we knew before. We've got estrogen receptor positive breast cancer. I'm not very good at multitasking here. I really need a pointer. That's that there. Can you see it? Yep. But in addition, we know that there's two other types of breast cancer. There's breast cancer that's what's called HER2 positive, and this is caused by an amplification of a gene called HER2. Now, we can see that by sequencing, but we can see it by much simpler manners. There's another type of breast cancer, and this is the third class, and this is called basal or basaloid breast cancer. It doesn't have estrogen receptor, so it would not respond to tamoxifen. So this is important. No good giving these individuals tamoxifen. It doesn't have the HER2 receptor. And this subclass of breast cancer is actually a bit of a challenge because we don't yet have targeted therapies for it. But I'll come back to that later. What was exciting, and this started, believe it or not, about 20 years ago. I was a postdoc back at NIH. This is not my work, but this was so much excitement at that time. And the excitement was really based on the fact, the discovery that about 20% of breast cancers had amplification of this gene called HER2. This really fueled the biotech industry. This discovery was made by basic research, but it really caught the excitement of the biotech industry, who realized that they could they could use this to develop therapeutics. And really much of the personalized medicine that we know now is based on some of these studies that have gone on in the last 20 years involving the biotech industry, involving the pharmaceutical industry to develop these types of technologies and treatments. So the HER2 receptor, this is a protein that's on the top of cells, so it's on the outside of a cell. And the exciting thing is we can then raise molecules that will actually bind to that receptor, and it will stop its function. Many of you will have read about these. This is called Herceptin. It's been in the clinic now for many years. It's been in clinical trials probably for 10 years. Each province in Canada has now agreed to pay for Herceptin in the healthcare system. But if we don't have a lot of money for these drugs, these are expensive drugs. So if we're going to treat patients with these drugs to target their tumors, in this case breast cancer, what's very important is that you develop simple tests, tests that can be executed in the clinic. And these are some of the earliest types of tests. So as I told you, this receptor is present on the cell surface. And those tumors that have amplified HER2, so they've got lots of HER2, they stain very dark. So they come out with this very strong brown color. This is a breast tumor that's HER2 positive. And we can easily see that by this stain. That's the one on the right-hand side. If the breast tumor is HER2 negative, so the ER positive tumors, for example, what you can see is that this looks very, very different when you stain it with the same antibody. So by using this test, you can decide that, well, this patient on the right-hand side should be treated with Herceptin. They're likely to respond to Herceptin, whereas the patient on the left-hand side does not have HER2, so it would not respond to Herceptin. But many of these patients are ER positive, so they would be treated with tamoxifen. So we've already started to treat patients with breast cancer in a personalized manner, tamoxifen, maybe with chemotherapy, or Herceptin, for example. To make this more accurate, there are other types of tests that can be used, and these are called fluorescence in situ hybridization. Oops, I've done something really bad to that. And I don't know, I hope I'm not, oh, yeah, that's bizarre. Okay, so this is just an, oh, I've done it again, Michelle.
What did you? Click on it.
Yes. No, I've gone to the next one, okay. So this is called fluorescence in situ hybridization, and again, the one on the left, which is your left, you can see these little dots, and these dots are showing the amplification of the HER2 receptor in the tumor cells. And the one on the right doesn't have any little green dots or only two green dots because we always have two copies of every gene, and you can see the difference. So again, this is used as a decision-making tool to give the patient on the left Herceptin, but not the patient on the right. And with these tools, we can really justify that decision to the healthcare system, to the provincial government, to pay for Herceptin for that patient because the patient is likely to respond. Now, what I said was that this has happened in the last 20 years. So, for example, HER2 was cloned in the 1980s. The first clinical trial, and it was identified to be amplified in breast cancer. The first clinical trials started in the 1990s. FDA approval for Herceptin, that means in the U.S. it was okay to use Herceptin, about 1999. And we now have, by 2005, the ability to support the use of Herceptin in the Canadian healthcare system. So here we're talking 25 years. That's about my life in science so far. I won't give you exactly. But that's a long, slow process. But we've learned an enormous amount from that process. Now we can speed things up. And the reason we can speed things up is in part because we've learned a lot. Sorry, this is one of these ones. From the challenges with Herceptin. And at about a similar time, another discovery was made. Again, this was made in the lab. This is really bench-to-bedside type research. And this discovery was that in chronic myelogenous leukemia, about 98% of these tumors had what's called a fusion between two genes. They're called BCR and Abelson. And the normal, in our normal cells, this is only one gene, Abelson. But what was exciting with this is, again, we could make a therapeutic that would target this new gene. And it was understood from studies in the lab that the BCR-Abelson fusion was absolutely critical for the development of chronic myelogenous leukemia. Since 97% of patients have this, this is understood to be a driver for that cancer. We can now treat patients with chronic myelogenous leukemia and BCR-ABL with a drug that targets the BCR-ABL gene, and you can follow the response to treatment. So these would be the patients with CML Following treatment with Gleevec, which inhibits this BCR-ABL fusion protein, you now get back to normal cells. Now, this, sadly, we're not curing these individuals, but we're actually preventing the progression of their disease. We have tests that can identify this at a much earlier stage, and we can prolong the stage at which these patients are in an early stage of the disease. So these are sort of examples, really, of what we would call bench to bedside. Most of these have actually come from discoveries in labs by students working in groups like the Goodman Center. You start by animal models. You begin to analyze this by different types of tests, and you then end up taking it to the clinic. Now, we've really entered, and at that stage, we were really trying, you know, we were searching like a needle in a haystack. It was just by luck that you would discover some of these changes. There was a lot of work, a lot of man hours to really develop and identify these alterations that happened in these cancers. But that was in the pre-genomic era. So as Ken showed, we've now really exploded. In the last 10 years, we sequenced the human genome. We've got many machines. We can now take a tumor. We can sequence it in a day. We can, as Michelle told you at the very beginning, we can find thousands of mutations in cancers. But what's important for us is to identify those changes that are important for the disease. If you sequence chronic myelogenous leukemia, you'll find many more alterations other than BCR-ABL. But every single tumor has BCR-ABL. And that tells you likely that that disease, that cancer is driven by that alteration. So there are challenges ahead, but these are very exciting times. And some of the excitement, and this is the difference, about 5 years ago it was established that about 50% of melanomas have a mutation in a gene called BRAF. Again, because we'd been studying this in the lab, there were already inhibitors made to BRAF. So the speed through which we discover mutations in BRAF, where we go into clinical trials and we actually see results, has now shrunk from 25 years down to 5 years. So these are some of the first trials. You'll probably see this in the newspapers. This has been in the New York Times. It's on the TV. But these are patients with melanoma. And, of course, because these are early-stage clinical trials, they're treating patients that have advanced-stage melanoma with the inhibitors to BRAF. And now we're at a stage where we can really see pretty strong remission of patients that are at a fairly advanced stage. Now, again, the question is, how long can we maintain this remission? Can we detect melanoma earlier? Can we treat the patients earlier, for example? But what this raises now is the need to develop tests to identify which of those individuals with melanoma actually have alterations in this RAF gene. So we can do that in the lab. This is the type of things we do. Ken could do that with his eyes closed, you know, before he had breakfast. But now we have to set up mechanisms and testing centers where we could then begin to test, for example, for these types of alterations. And these would become what we would call personalized medicine. This is really a tool that where you would treat melanoma patients with a drug that really targets the gene that causes the tumor. So we're really at a stage now where we see too many things. We can see thousands of mutations. But as I said, we have to understand which of these are really important for that cancer. So by taking this approach, we've gone from an era from the bench to the bedside, and really now we're starting with the patient. We're actually starting with the patient. We then go to the bench, perhaps through a sequencing facility, and we go back to the patient. And this has really revolutionized how we really begin to think about disease and how we would treat cancer. So I just wanted to take a couple of minutes, and I decided not to present our own work, but really, what would you need to facilitate these discoveries? Most of these are made by collecting tissue, by looking at from the perspective of cancer, we would like to look within the cancer tissue. And we'd want to compare the cancer tissue to the normal tissue from the same individual. So because of that, we've actually started a tissue bank. We started this about 10 years ago at the MUHC, where we've banked breast cancer. We bank breast cancer tissues very rapidly. So the difference between this bank and old tissue banks is that we bank the tissue very quickly. We freeze it so that the quality of the tissue is exceptional and is suitable for the types of tests that Ken could run on these big machines. This is also useful for other tests, and we usually try to bank normal tissue from the same individual. This is tissue that normally actually is thrown out by the pathology department because pathology uses what it needs, and anything extra we can then bank in our tissue bank. And we've got particular questions that we want to ask with this, but the very important thing for us is that we capture all of the clinical information. So this isn't where you live and how old you, well, it is how old you are, but, you know, it's not where you live and anything, but really we're capturing what were you treated with, when were you diagnosed, what type of anesthesiology did you get, all that information we put in a database. We don't link it to your names so that nobody can find you, but we are linked so that we can go back and get follow-up because it's very important to know if this individual treated in this way survived or did not survive. What's exciting for us then is that we can use these new technologies. And our questions, what we're interested in and excited about, is to compare the normal tissue to the tumor tissue, and we can take sections because the tissue's of very good quality, and we can run these types of genetic-type tests that Ken was talking about. And these types of tests are now being used. Some of you may have heard about a test called Oncotype DX. This is what's called a gene signature that will allow you to decide between good outcome and bad outcome in breast cancer. And these types of tests, again, will be coming to the clinic. 2 minutes, Michelle, and I'll be done. So there are challenges, and we should question this. Who should be offered testing? How do we put these tests into practice? Is this by our general practitioners? Well, the answer is no. How should the test be integrated into the current standard of care? These are all challenges that we must address. If we're narrowing the target population, if we were to tell you that your cancer wouldn't really benefit from that treatment, would you be happy with that? Or would you want to try everything? Everything that you could get. Even if somebody said, well, when I look at your tumor and I sequence it, I don't think you're going to benefit from that. So these will be hard decisions to make. This will require a lot of research and decision-making theories, basically, to know. These are complex decisions for the general population. These are complex decisions for people that, like ourselves. There are social issues. If we all send our DNA away to be sequenced, the likelihood is in 10 years we may do that. We may find out we have predispositions for different diseases, diabetes, Parkinson's, whatever. Would that change you? Would you change? Would you become more healthy? Would you stop drinking? Would you change your eating habits? Would you exercise more? Would you stop smoking? You know, it's very difficult to impart change. And do we want to know that? Do we want to know our destiny? And so if we do go down this avenue, these will be quite difficult social questions that we will have to address as a society, but we will have to address within the healthcare system too. Thank you. Sorry.
Thank you very much. I'm not sure. I think if you don't mind, we're going to go to Mark, and then we're all going to be together because I think there'll be questions that will overlap on everybody. But a wonderful introduction also for Mark. Mark, we talked about going to your physicians and discussing this issue, that these are medical geneticists that do this. And Mark, that's what he does on a daily basis. So, Mark, welcome in. And I know that you have your mic.
Let's put the mic up a bit for me, I think. There you go. Okay, well, thank you very much for the invite. So the title of my talk is Moving from the Lab to the Clinic, Personalized Prediction of Cancer Risk and Treatment Response. And I don't have any conflicts of interest to declare. I'm going to talk about quite a few different companies, and et cetera, but I'm not funded by any of them. Okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to look at a family. And to understand this, you're going to have to understand a little bit of how we draw out families in the genetics clinic. The key points are, when you look at this slide, that the squares are the men and the circles are the women. And all the circles that are coloured in black means that they're affected with cancer. And underneath I've written the ages at which they're affected, and I've written BR for breast cancer and OV for ovarian cancer. So you can see that the key person here is going to be Rachel. She's had breast cancer at the age of 45. And she's actually, that's her father, who's deceased. And that's her aunt, who's also deceased, but had breast cancer. And there's quite a history of breast cancer here, up here with her grandmother and another aunt, and an aunt with ovarian cancer as well. Now, she's going to be the main person we're going to talk about, but we're also going to talk about Anna, who's the cousin. So they're linked through their mother and father, Anna's mother and Rachel's father were brother and sister. So those are the key people that we're going to talk about in my session. So how would we have managed this family back in 1990? Well, I don't remember too much about 1990 because I was a student at the time, but I do remember a pint of beer was about £1.20, which I think is about $2. And I think Brian Mulroney was president at the time, prime minister. Not present, prime minister. And this was the latest computer that we had at the time. This was a Mac, highly advanced at the time. Now, I picked 1990 for two main reasons, really. Firstly, this was the start of the Human Genome Project. Okay, so we've already heard a bit about this, but this is when the Genome Project started. It was also a landmark year in breast cancer genetics, because this was the first year that we actually located one of the genes that causes breast cancer when it's inherited. And this gene was called BRCA1. We didn't actually find it, but we actually located it to a place in on a chromosome where we knew it would be. It actually took another 4 years to actually pin it down further. But it was a landmark at the time. So what would we have done with this family? Firstly, with Rachel, if she came to the clinic back in 1990. Well, as Morag's already alluded to, we would have checked her estrogen receptor, ER, and progesterone receptor status. And she would have been given a combination of chemotherapy, radiotherapy, and surgery, plus or minus hormonal therapy at the time. But beyond that, it wouldn't have been particularly tailored to any particular subtype of breast cancer or anything. It was fairly standard treatment. The good thing was though, that she was diagnosed. If she was diagnosed in 1990, that would have been right at the cusp of when we started to see an improvement in survival of women who had breast cancer. So this is the actual rate of death of women who had breast cancer. And you can see the curve was going up, and then around about 1990 it started going down. Probably due to a combination of different things, such as screening, such as improvements in treatment, and also the fact that all the doctors started working together in combined focused teams rather than working in little silos. So that's Anna. So what about, that's Rachel. So what about Anna? Now, she's obviously worried because of her risk. You know, she's in the same family as Rachel, but she's got a mother who had breast cancer, and she's probably at risk of getting breast cancer herself. But could we actually tell her whether or not she is at risk? Well, to be honest, there wouldn't have been much that we could have done at the time. We could have tried to track, maybe, because we knew roughly where the BRCA1 gene was, we could have tried to track that gene through the family and maybe offered her some testing, but we probably wouldn't have done that at the time. So we would have probably said to her, you know, you can actually have a preventative mastectomy, so you can have your breast tissue removed, but we don't actually know whether, as a surgical procedure, because you might be at increased risk, but we don't really know whether you've inherited the gene or not. Okay, so not too much useful advice there for Anna. Okay, so let's go forward to 2010. We have a different prime minister. We have much faster computers, about 1,000 times faster than they were in 1990. This is something else that Ken alluded to, that in fact the genetic technology is directly parallel to our computing power. We have most universities now have a program in cancer genetics, such as we have our own here. We have companies. This is one company that offers commercial testing for some of the breast cancer susceptibility genes. And we have international consortia of different researchers who all work together to identify new genes. And in 1990, we barely knew about one gene, and now we know about more than 20 in that period of time. And these are all genes that if you inherit them, they increase your risk of breast cancer. So coming back to this, coming back to our family, if we saw them today, we would have added in, now we would also do Herceptin status, as Maura talked about this. And if Rachel did express the HER2 receptor, she would be offered Herceptin. Now this has been, as Maura said, this has been a real paradigm shift, a real jump in the way that we treat our patients. Sure, there will have been advances in surgery and radiotherapy over the last 20 years as well, but they all tend to be incremental. When something like Herceptin comes along, it's a real jump, a leap forward. And she may also have been offered tamoxifen plus or minus new hormonal drugs such as aromatase inhibitors. And beyond that, we can also actually look at her breast cancer in much more detail and subdivide it. And we can also do some genomic profiling. There's a company, Morag's already mentioned it, called Oncotype DX, which actually takes a profile of 19 different genes and looks at them, and it can work out whether or not chemotherapy is actually indicated. So by doing this sort of work, you can actually target the right drugs to the right person. All this work is a result, really, of our better understanding of breast cancer. And this is one example. There is a particular type of breast cancer called medullary breast cancer, which looks like this under the microscope. And we've always known it's a bit different because we've been looking at it under the microscope for many, many years, and it looks slightly unusual compared to other breast cancers. More recently, we've been able to use more sophisticated techniques, such as immunohistochemistry, to use specific markers to look at these types of cancers, subtypes of breast cancer in more detail. And this can be now done in a good pathology lab. We also know that this particular subtype is related or is often caused by mutations in the BRCA1 gene. So we now have a direct link between the type of breast cancer that you have and also the potential genetic predisposition that you may have. Furthermore, we are beginning to understand that certain treatments, such as certain types of... I've done the same thing as you. There we go. Thank you. Yeah. So we now know that certain types of breast cancer are linked to certain genes, and there are certain treatments for these specialized types of breast cancer that might be very specific and might be very useful. So carboplatin is one chemotherapy drug that's been around for a while, but has actually shown to show increased activity in this type of breast cancer. And there are also new drugs called PARP inhibitors, which also seem to be very specific. Now, this isn't just... I'm talking mainly about breast cancer tonight, but there are other drugs that have come along that are similar in terms of targeted therapies to Herceptin and Gleevec that we've already heard about. I've given some examples here. They all have quite long names, but they target different... You can see they've all come along in the last decade. They all target different cancers. Now, problems with them are that they're all very expensive, and I think we've already heard about that. And they're all not quite as successful as the original ones. So the Herceptin and the Gleevec were really the really exciting ones. And all the ones subsequently to that have been not quite as exciting. But nevertheless, these drugs are being developed and they are being used in different in tumor types. So what about Anna? Well, now we can offer her BRCA1 and 2 testing. So what we can do is we would test Rachel first. We would identify the gene mutation that is running in this family that's causing all this breast cancer. And we would then find out whether Anna has inherited that gene from her mother or not. If she hasn't inherited that gene mutation, then her risk of breast cancer will be the same as the general population, and we can reassure her. If she has inherited the breast cancer mutation, then she's going to be at higher risk of breast cancer herself. Now, these mutations are relatively rare, but they are frequent in certain ethnic groups, such as the Ashkenazi Jewish population, and they're also we also see certain mutations more commonly in the French Canadian population. And they also, if you carry one of these genes, and this is all work that we do on a daily basis in our clinic, we know that your risk of breast and ovarian cancer is much higher than the general population. So the general population risk is about 1 in 10. Lifetime risk 10%. If you carry a BRCA1 or BRCA2 mutation, your lifetime risk of breast cancer is between 50 and 80%. So now what can we offer Anna in this modern age? Well, the first thing is we can offer a much more improved surveillance. So the picture is... So this is a mammogram showing of a breast, and this is the equivalent breast with using MRI screening. And I think you'll all agree it's much easier to see the cancer on this compared to this. So we now offer MRI screening for women who carry mutations. Now, we don't offer this to every woman in the general population because the MRIs are so sensitive that they pick up every single little lump, and it would be unfeasible currently to offer this to every woman in the general population because you'd just be running backwards all the time for further biopsies and investigations. But if you have a very high risk of breast cancer to start off with, then this sort of imaging is extremely helpful. And again, we can offer preventative surgery, but now we know for sure that if Anna has a BRCA1 mutation, we know for sure that she's going to be at increased risk. Now, we also know about many other genes. We focus very much on the two genes, BRCA1 and 2, and we know about other genes. And there's a particular group down here on the ones in red there that actually are very common in the general population but only slightly increase your risk. So they may just increase your risk by a few percent. But if you carry enough of these, your risk will be significantly elevated. And the concept here is that we could use this information to modify who actually gets screening for breast cancer and who doesn't. Because at the moment, every woman at the age of 50 is eligible for breast cancer screening. But every 50-year-old woman has a slightly different risk depending on which combination of genes she's inherited. So the idea is to genetically profile women and to actually then target who actually needs screening. And you can increase the frequency in those women who need it more, and you can reassure other women who don't need it. And you can apply this to other cancers. So for breast cancer, you could read prostate cancer in men. It's the same principle, the same advances are happening, the same discussions are being held with clinicians interested in prostate cancer and in colon cancer. Now, there are already companies online who offer this sort of testing, but I think it's still a bit early because they're not very validated. They also charge a lot of money for it, and I think most clinicians are a bit wary about this sort of online advertising at the moment. Okay, so what will we do in 2025? Well, I think Clara Hughes will be Prime Minister at that stage, and I've just given you some examples. We've already talked about the human genome, how much it cost $3 billion to do in 1990. Right now, it probably costs about $10,000, and we can do it in about 2 months. In a couple of years' time, it'll be a tenth of that price. In 2025, this is the sort of test that we'll probably be able to do at your family doctor's. The technology will be there to do it. Whether or not he wants to do it is a different question, but the technology will be there. We may also be able to do it to newborns, when someone's born. At the moment, we do a Heelbrick test to test them for certain diseases. Well, it would be quite feasible in 15 years' time to actually genetically profile a newborn. In terms of our family, well, for Rachel, we will be able to completely sequence her tumor. We've already heard that we can already do this now in the lab, but I think we'll be able to do this in a clinical setting in 15 years' time. So we'll be able to do tumor molecular profiling and extremely focused targeted therapy. For Anna, we'll be able to further refine her risk because at the moment when we see a BRCA1 carrier, we give them a large range, 50 to 80% risk. That still means that some women with these genetic mutations will not develop breast cancer. But if we can actually sequence the rest of the genome and look at which genes are modifying the risk, then we can give a more precise risk. And there will be targeted chemotherapy. Now, I put a question mark next to gene therapy because I still think that's a way off. And we've been, it's been around for a while now, and it's a very difficult process. And I'll come back to that later on. The other thing we can offer Anna and or even Rachel's daughter here is... We can offer reproductive options. So if for example, Anna carried the BRCA1 mutation but didn't want to, but was planning to have children and didn't want to pass it on, the gene on to her children, then she could select her eggs that don't carry the mutation and have them fertilized. Now, this is already happening. This is already feasible. Okay. But it's not being done on a big scale, and but this may well, again, the reproductive technology will improve, and this will become easier and easier to do in the future. So what sort of issues does this raise? Well, I think one of the big worries that I have is if you're going around screening everyone's genome, you're going to find other diseases apart from cancer. So you may predict, you know, that they have an early susceptibility to Alzheimer's disease, for example, something like diabetes or something else. So, and this can also happen when you're actually sequencing a tumor. You may find genes, therefore, you know, diseases that the person you're treating doesn't really want to know about. There may be insurance issues and genetic discrimination. Now, this was first raised when the breast cancer genes were first discovered. It hasn't really appeared as a problem in our clinics, but if everyone has genomic profiling, it may be that the insurance companies do have enough information to use this in insurance issues. At the moment, they don't have enough information, but this might change it. And this may also lead to a loss of autonomy. So, you know, if we're screening newborns for, you know, genetic profiling them, well, we're taking away their own choice of whether or not they want to know about these conditions, which are only going to affect them in adulthood anyway. So these are all issues that we need to actually grapple with now, because this technology is moving very quickly. Okay, so, and I think I'm just going to finish now by talking about touching on what Ken's talked about. Now, we're already very good at sequencing DNA and reading the code. But if you sequence these two individuals, even though, you know, they are different, you know, their genetic code will be, you know, 98-99% similar. So actually reading the sequence isn't helping us that much to discriminate between different individuals. And as Ken alluded to as well, you know, at the moment we're very good at reading the genetic code itself, but there are multiple different levels to this. So, you know, I mean, for example, my daughter likes Dora the Explorer. Now, you can read, you know, 100 Dora the Explorer books, and you'll be very good at that, but you won't appreciate a Shakespeare sonnet. And if you read 1,000 Dora the Explorer books, you still won't be able to understand Shakespeare with it. So we're still very much at the Dora stage. But I think, you know, with the way things are going, we are moving towards Shakespeare. So I'd like to finish there, and thank you very much for your attention.
So I don't know where Morak went, but I would like if you can come in front, and Ken, and as soon as he's coming back, I think biological break is very important. We're at the end of our evening. I will go up and down, or maybe Petal, you can go and get the cards, and we can ask questions at the same time. So this is working. We can start with the gentleman in the back. Petal, just behind you, there's a gentleman which has a question.
My question is directed to the lady speaker.
Dr. Park.
Yeah. First of all, I'd like to thank you for delivering such a good talk, which I find really informative. And given she has talked about genes, genetics, and genomics, if there is no cancer history at all among my ancestors or my forefathers, is the likelihood that I be declared of the disease still present? And if so, to what extent, how much would be such a likelihood? And ultimately, why? And what are the factors that could lead to the diagnosis.
Thank you very much. So if you don't have any cancer in your family, what's your rate?
I mean, that's a very good question. What is your rate? I think depends on, to a certain extent, your lifestyle. Is this on? No, I've got to put that on, I think. It's on? Okay. What the rate of chance of getting cancer would in part depend on your lifestyle. There's very good evidence, for example, that smoking is a contributing factor to lung cancer. We saw the rate of lung cancer increase, particularly in men, when men were smoking. Now there is a decrease in men smoking, you see a decrease in lung cancer. The same is true now for women. We're seeing an increase in lung cancer in women who started to smoke later than men. So this is an absolute correlation. There's also definitely a link with different alcohols, with inactivity and obesity. Maybe other people would like to add some other things. But there's no doubt that lifestyle does contribute to cancer. And if you look at the World Health statistics, it can be up to about 30% of cancers that are contributed by environmental toxins, for example, smoking and other types of health hazards.
Cool.
After that, some of these, the rest is, to a certain extent, chance. In addition to perhaps the types of risk factors, these genes that Mark was talking about that may predispose you but not necessarily cause the cancer.
Thank you very much, Mark. So really, lifestyle is... There's a question behind you over there, but just before, I have a question here. Mark, can you elaborate on the assay test to determine if chemo is useful or not? So this is offered everywhere, in every hospital, or maybe you can talk about that.
It's coming in right now. It's not offered everywhere, and until recently it was offered as part of a trial basis.
Is it paid by the government?
In Quebec, right now we're working on it.
Okay, it's not at this time.
But there are issues about the validity of it as well. It's you can speak to different clinicians. It's people are not completely sold on it. And I think one of the things that's important to realize is that it's useful really. There's a whole spectrum of breast cancer. At one end, they're the good prognosis ones, the small breast cancers, which are easily treated with surgery. You may not even need radiotherapy or chemotherapy. And on the other side, they're really aggressive ones. Now, in the middle, there's a gray area where some of the breast cancers have some factors that suggest they're aggressive, but other factors that suggest that they don't need any aggressive treatment. And this sort of Oncotype DX, this sort of assay, will be useful particularly in that group, where the clinicians are really not sure. You don't really have any other factors that are pointing in one direction or not, whether or not to have chemotherapy. And in those groups as well, often the benefit of chemotherapy is quite marginal.
Thank you. So,
hello. This question is for Dr. Murak Park. I just would like your opinion on something. What do you think of a multi-thronged targeted therapies at low doses intending to elicit synergetic effect of chemo, radio, and hormonal therapies until resistance of the tumor to the therapies is reached and then increase gradually in succession until the tumor is destroyed?
So I'm not sure.
It's quite a complex question, but if we take it at a simple level, you're asking about multi-targeted therapies and at low dose. So rather than give very high doses of chemo or radiation, lower doses. There's no doubt what they found, particularly, for example, with Herceptin in treating breast cancer, that this is actually more efficient when given with low-dose chemo. And many of those therapeutics that we're now linking to personalized medicine are often very efficient when given with low-dose chemo, for example. And sometimes that's because when you stop the function of this gene called HER2 or some of these other genes, you actually predispose the tumor cells to go through a mechanism of death so that they are very sensitive to death, and the chemotherapy under these conditions will push the tumor cells to die. And I think you were asking at the end about resistance or stepping up the dose. That I wouldn't be as experienced to talk about that. There's no doubt that there are different clinical trials on at the moment by looking at starting with low doses and building up to higher doses. It's very interesting, this indication I gave you about the BRAF and melanoma. Again, these are clinical trials ongoing now. Some patients are responding very well to low doses. Other patients need higher doses. This may reflect part of our genetic makeup as well, how our immune response responds, and many other factors.
Thank you very much. Ken, I have a question. Oh, you want to add something?
Well, I would just add that multi-agent treatment has been around for a long time, and that's, when you give someone chemotherapy these days, it is usually a combination of drugs, either at the same time or sequentially. And the other point I would add is that many of the new drugs like Herceptin and Gleevec, they're not particularly dose dependent. So if you increase the dose beyond a certain level, it doesn't make any difference. And they're also relatively free of side effects as well. So you don't get any of the toxicity, you know, like hair loss, nausea, and all these things that you get with chemotherapies.
Ken, there's a question here for you. If I give you $50, would you sequence my genome? So if you go to the genome center and you go with your buddies and you drink a lot, but you save a bit of money, can you get your genome before the morning?
No, not quite yet, unfortunately.
But is this something that the genome center eventually may become a service center for people? If we look in the directions of the future that Mark talked to us about.
So our particular genome center, who knows, is that the way the world is moving? Certainly, and there will be, and there already are. There are already wealthy individuals who pay to have their own genome sequenced, like I think Mark talked about. There's a boutique aspect to it now because you can sequence your own genome and you'll have a list of so many, many polymorphisms that you just don't know where to start. And I think this is, for me, where in the next series of years, we're going to be developing sort of the research infrastructure that's much better at essentially separating the wheat from the chaff and knowing sort of what's the background noise and having experimental designs that will then point to what's something that's occurring, whether a specific mutation or a mutation load on a gene or a pathway, that we can start saying this is a real association and not just an artifact.
Question for Morag here. The question is that this person got breast cancer. Both alleles were amplified, and it's also ER positive 60%. So not sure if it's a clinical one, it should be you or Morag. So in this case, when you have automatically amplification of HER2, is it typical to have Herceptin, I would think? So yes, this person is asking, what would be the best treatment out there?
Sorry, you said when HER2 is amplified?
Yep.
I mean, this always should be judged by your clinician. But clearly, under the situation where HER2 is amplified, many of these individuals would be suitable for Herceptin treatment. Mm-hmm. Probably if they're ER positive, they may also be given, as Mark said, tamoxifen or the new aromatases. But really, this is something that must be decided by the clinician and the team that are treating the individual.
I was just before we started, I was at a table making my computer with making a slide with two nice individuals, and they were talking about treatment and this question is probably not from them, but I think it relates to what we were discussing. Is it correct to state that all clinical trials should include genetic makeup right now? Because people come in clinics all the time now. In fact, clinicians and team of clinicians and scientists are competing for patients to enroll in their clinical trials. So they are asked by many different people doing different things. And so what should they do?
Well, we can both answer. But I know that many of the clinical trials, particularly those that are starting, where we have already knowledge that we would like to know the genetic alterations, particularly in cancers, that may not decide how the patients are treated at the moment, but it would be very useful to then follow afterwards when you look at outcome. One of the challenges is actually cost, because to bank tissue is actually quite expensive. So all of the clinical trials, if we want to bank match tissue and then set up the types of databases that we have, for example, this adds extra cost to the trial. And many of these tissues you would want to bank as frozen material. At the moment, pathology banks tissue, but this is all formalin fixed material. So the pathology departments are really geared to that. So many new clinical trials moving forward, though, will be banking frozen tissue or biopsy material, and that this is really a way of the future. But it adds extra expenses, extra complications to handling the tissue in the hospitals.
At the Massachusetts General Hospital, now they have clinical trials. I was told by Phil Sharp this week that every single patient is sequenced coming in. So they paid $2,000, but the difference is paid by the clinical trials.
So what this is the sequence at the moment in a number of centers. The most prevalent 200 mutations that have been found in cancer. So the cancers coming in will be sequenced for these mutations. So this is obviously something that we should be discussing and is under discussion in Canada. Some institutions have the capacity for that. And this is something that we hopefully moving forward will set up as pilot tests. And the questions are, though, do we sequence in every center? I think the answer is no. This will not be like your general pathology labs. We may have to have limited centers across the country where this material is sent to with quality control, you know, all the bells and whistles that when you get a result, you know that that result has been really gone through stringent quality control. So this is under discussion. We're very aware of it in the country. All countries expensive. Are addressing this at the moment.
It's expensive. There's a question in the back.
Hi. I don't know if you can answer this question. Do you know how does Canada compare with the U.S. or Europe in terms of this personalized cancer treatment?
Maybe Mark can take this. He's a British guy, so should. You're a Scottish lady, too. But Scots and I don't know.
Well, I think in terms of what we're offering in genetics, we're doing very well here, actually. I would say we offer genetic testing to individuals. Often this is done according to international guidelines, and we comply with those guidelines, essentially. So I think, in general, we're doing well. We sort of take a fairly rational approach to treatment. So you also have to look at the effectiveness of treatment. Not every new treatment is necessarily better than the one before. So it's always important to look at treatments in terms of trials and also to follow them up in a longer-term framework. So I think, in general, we do pretty well here. Certainly, my experience here is mainly compared to the UK, and it's fairly comparable there. I think where we probably lack a little bit here is in the primary care prevention, because I think the whole system of family doctors is less well organised here. And I certainly know in the UK, the family doctors have all the power. It's not the specialist in the hospital; it's the family.
It's probably more than we have here. I can tell you, it's hard to get physicians these days. Yeah.
Very brief. I just came back from meetings in the UK and France on personalized medicine in the healthcare system. And I would say we're sitting at about the same position at the moment. So what you heard from Michelle was that in some hospitals in the US, they will sequence these mutations. But we always see that in the US, different centers, each center will do things a bit differently. So these are really sort of boutique hospitals. So if we're thinking on a healthcare system, we have to think a little bit more.
Absolutely right, because the discussion was that these hospitals in the U.S. also attract customers, which are patients. So if they offer the new techniques, they have more people coming in. So it's really a question of marketing. It reminds me that if we do well here, we have an English guy, a Scots lady, and a Dutch guy, too. I have a joke about that. It was a Scot. No, sorry. So we must attract good scientists here. Obviously, we are there. So don't answer that, Ken. No worry. I have a few more questions. What is the state of pancreatic cancer treatment? Maybe Mark can answer that. On pancreatic cancer treatment, is this there's anything in individualized medicine in pancreatic cancer, which is a very little cancer?
Pancreatic cancer, unfortunately, is one of the hardest cancers to treat out of all of them. I mean, the ones that are really difficult are ones like lung and pancreatic cancer. The ones that are in the easier field are breast cancer and colon cancer. So pancreatic cancer is a tough one to treat, but there's a lot of research going on looking at genomic profiling of cancer, looking at genetic predispositions to pancreatic cancer as well. In my own work, I found certain links with genes that predispose to both breast and pancreatic cancer, for example. So there's a lot of work in this field. In terms of agents that work, chemotherapy hasn't been very successful, and radiotherapy doesn't work either. And that really explains why the prognosis is still quite poor in it. But I think that as we get more of these targeted treatments, we will identify one specifically for this cancer as well.
Yeah, please go ahead.
In the middle of this. What's quite exciting is there's a large project, and we didn't actually talk about that, to sequence cancer genomes. So just like the sequencing of the normal genome, but these are actually sequencing 500 pancreatic cancers, 500 lung cancers, to really look at those mutations that are important for that disease. And Canada is the home to sequence the pancreatic cancer genome. So hopefully within a few years, we will begin to understand how to treat that cancer.
I have a very interesting question here. And it's something that, I've thought about that in the past. Is there individual which have a mutation like increase of HER2 or other mutation known to give cancer, which do not have cancer? And so is that possible? So one of those very driving mutations you will find in the family, probably more Mark in this, but more I can answer that too, will have the mutations in the family and they don't have cancer.
Well, HER2 is not a familial alteration, so this would be something that would happen in the cells that give rise to the cancer. However, that said, there has been a large study, for example, of trauma patients, patients who have been killed in car crashes where they've allowed, you know, their bodies to be given to science. And when they actually do a study, they do find that many of us are walking around with many of these alterations that you do find in cancers, yet we don't have cancer. And so these are actually very important questions. Do many of us have small cancers that are dormant and our immune system manages to suppress them? And even some of the work from my own lab looking in breast cancer, particularly at that aspect, we do find that individuals with a strong immune response, a positive immune response in the tumor bed, in the microenvironment, have a much better outcome of that tumor than individuals that don't. So I think there's many things that we have to learn. And Mark, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's a very interesting question, and certainly when we're talking about the breast cancer genes that I talked about, we know that not everyone who inherits one of those genes gets breast cancer. Probably about a third of women who inherit those genes, in fact, don't get breast cancer. And we don't understand why, if you inherit this gene, you know, why some people, even in the same family, some people will develop breast cancer at, you know, in their 20s, some will develop it, you know, in their 50s, and some women won't develop it at all. And the way we're dealing with this is by collecting large numbers of these families. So these families are individually rare, but we work together in international consortia. And the one that McGill's part of has currently collected 18,000 women throughout the world. And only with those large numbers can you perform the statistical analysis to work out exactly what other modifying factors are happening in these families to make one woman get breast cancer and the other one not.
A good example of people that smoke until 95 years old, you still smoke.
They're not many of those, though.
Not many of those, but there are some. You know, anyway, I'm not going to push smoking here. I'll be killed by my colleague. A quick question here. Is somebody has quite a lot of money and wants to go to your clinic and needs 50 different genes, and all of them, he sees this on the web, wants to have all those markers, can they have it in Montreal?
Well, we do actually sometimes refuse genetic testing to people because we do not think they're eligible for it. But we do, if they want to pay for it themselves, then you know we're happy to arrange that for them. So we don't stop people doing it.
Is it typical of your hospital? If it's true all over Montreal?
Well, for example, the test for the BRCA1 and 2 genes costs about $3,500 to do. Okay, so
that's paid, though. That's probably paid.
It's paid by the government, yeah. But we limit it to people who we think there really is a clinical indication for it.
Okay, we're almost there. I know it's starting to the end. I have two more questions here. What advice would you? I'm just going to read it. What advice would you give to a 39-year-old female whose mother and aunt on the maternal side have had breast cancer? Should they be tested? Should they go through all of this in the family? If there's two people in the family who are tested?
I would need a bit more information. Particularly would be important to know what ages they had the diagnosis. Because if you know, two women had breast cancer in their 70s or 80s in the family, well, that's unlikely to be genetic. But if they were in their 40s, then that's a bit more relevant. The other key point is what ethnic group are they from? So if they are, for example, from a family of Jewish ancestry, well, then that increases the risk that there might be a genetic predisposition to breast cancer running in the family.
So
come and see me afterwards. I'm quite easy to spot.
Do people come to see you to know, hey, I have a family?
Yeah, that's exactly the sort of thing that we come and see, but we'd want a bit more information. What we normally do is that people get referred to us and we send them out a questionnaire asking them these specific questions.
So people can at least get information from that.
Yes. Yes.
That's very useful. Yes, thank you.
Thank you. It seems to me that one of the challenges the healthcare system is going to have with better and better diagnostic tools and research, how are you going to be able to feed it back to the prevention and early stage diagnosis in the especially in the current system where it's very difficult to get to see a GP, let alone a specialist.
I think this is an excellent question. This is being discussed definitely at the CIHR and Health Canada. This, and I think Mark raised this, in the UK there is much more of these decisions are made at the GP. At the same time, many of the GPs are not so comfortable with the types of new information and genetic testing, so there is a need at this stage to provide tools to GPs to make decisions and to point directions to individuals. There are definitely is quite a lot of research that's being stimulated in that area at the moment to engage and increase the comfort zone and awareness of GPs in Canada. And, of course, to provide more GPs is probably what we need.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Question?
Juste pour revenir un peu sur la question de la jeune femme, en fait, c'est bien beau de savoir, disons, si on est porteur du gène BRCA1, par exemple, mais il faut savoir, faut être prêt à qu'est-ce qu'on fait après, puis c'est ça, ou vos recommandations, si quelqu'un est testé ou pas, est positif ou pas à une mutation, il faut être prêt à savoir qu'est-ce qu'on fait, puis vous, qu'est-ce que vous recommandez dans ces cas-là?
Si on est porteur, c'est pas
une mutation. We can say it in English, sorry.
You want me to torture you with my French? I can do that.
Ce serait intéressant en français. Vas-y, Marc. Vas-y.
Okay.
So, je suis curieux, moi.
In English, well, if you're a mutation carrier, the main things that we offer are increased surveillance. The example that I gave was using MRI screening to focus in on breast cancers. We normally start screening, you know, from the mid-20s onwards. So that is important because the younger you pick up a breast cancer, the earlier you pick up a breast cancer, the more treatable it is. You know, if it's less than a centimeter, you probably just need an operation. You don't need radiotherapy or chemotherapy. So that's the big thing, is increased surveillance. Now, the trouble is we can also offer, we also discuss chemo prevention. So we can give drugs like tamoxifen to women who are increased risk of breast cancer. The problem with that is that these drugs have side effects themselves. So most women who carry mutations at the moment do not take chemo prevention, and I think that's an area that I'd really like to see, you know, advance more quickly. You know, where we actually get safer drugs that actually can prevent these cancers occurring in the first place.
Thank you.
Some women, you know, it's a very personal decision. But if they've seen, you know, their mother die of breast cancer at a young age and their sister die, then they will opt for a preventative mastectomy. So they will have their breasts removed and reconstructed. And that's, you know, that happens. A certain proportion of women do that. And I know it's not a great option, but, you know, if you've lived with that in your family and you've got young children and you want to minimize your risk of breast cancer, then that's the choice that you will take.
What a difficult question. We're almost at the end. What I'm going to do is give them to think a bit. I'm going to answer this question myself. And I'll give you about 20 seconds, 30 seconds each to finish on your take-home message for people. Okay, so think about this. The question I have here is, do we understand how the identified allele increased the risk for breast cancer? But I would say to you, this is what we do every day in the lab. All these mutations, but we have a lot, as mentioned to you, 300.
Can you repeat that?
So I can repeat in English. Okay, I got it. Okay, do we understand how the identified allele, I assume the mutations we found, increase the risk for breast cancer? So your final comment could be on that or not. I mean, but if anybody wants to answer that, I'm still going to give you 30 seconds to take the take-home message for everybody.
I think it comes back to, you know, partly what Ken and I were saying about, you know, we understand instructions at one level, but we don't understand higher levels of complexity. So, you know, for example, with BRCA1, we know that if you carry a mutation in this, you're going to get breast cancer. But why does this, and we also know this gene is very fundamental. So it actually repairs DNA within all the cells within the body. So why does this particular gene that has a universal function in all the cells in the body only cause breast cancer and ovarian cancer? That's still a question that we don't understand, and that's something, you know, that people are working on.
That's our job, in fact, at the center. We do this every day, looking at mutations, finding ways how these genes cause cancer and which ones interact with which. We hope, in fact, we'll give you the tools to be able to answer that. So now we're at the end of our evening. And what I'll ask, maybe starting with Ken on this, if you have any last take-home message for the people about sequencing, they should be scared. You know, at the end of Mark's talk, I was starting to remember Gattaca, a famous movie. If anybody else saw this movie? Oh, what a scary movie, huh? So I was really that the
So is genomics bringing us into that era where we will have the population decided which one will have a nice genes, which one don't?
So instead, I could tell you a story of why Canada wasn't invited.
In 30 seconds? Go ahead.
It's just because it's a cute story. So sequencing the human genome was an international project, and many, many countries involved, and Canada was not one of them. And the way I heard it, this story was something like this. They were interviewing, I don't know where the Dutch guy came from, because I'm actually...
He's Scottish.
Well, I'm not Scottish, I'm Canadian, Scottish, but anyway. So go ahead. No.
You're not Dutch?
No.
Where did I saw that?
So anyway, so they're interviewing me, and they, you know, it was a test. They had to see sequence and read the sequence of a little bit of DNA. And so they asked the British guy, and he, A, C, G, whatever his accent was, you know, asked the American, A, C, G. They got the Canadian's turn, and it was, that's a C, eh? Yep, that's a G, eh? Yep, that's a T, eh?
You know, French Canadian like to say that joke, you know. And that's why we hate the country, right?
So,
I got it.
So anyway, as my take-home message, sort of naively, everyone expected genomics to be the end of the process, and it's actually the beginning. It's an enabling technology that puts things in a certain framework that then the real work can be done.
But my point on this is that more technology is easier to use. More should be controlled by the populations that pay for it now in many ways, because now the difference between using this in our society versus our technology and science mm-hmm. is so slim, the difference. And we talk about insurance and everything. Mm-hmm. Insurance will use it. The day you allow them to use the sequence, they'll use it. So I think it's very scary. Your 30 seconds worth
of... 30 seconds. I would say I do believe we're living in exciting times. I think there are many discoveries to be made in the next few years, particularly in cancer. However, this will make it confusing. The more knowledge we have, the more decisions we'll have to make, the more challenges we'll have to face. And as I tried to allude to, the decision-making tools within the healthcare system and how the healthcare system can pay for this will become a debate. Especially with the healthcare renewal in 2014, this will be on the table, and we'll probably all have been fed up by hearing about it by the time that comes along. But it's here. The train is out the station. There are exciting things out there, but we have to put them into practice.
Thank you very much. Mark?
Yeah, I mean, I would agree very much with what Maureen said. I think this is an amazing time. We're on the threshold of a new era here. But, you know, as ever, you know, the technology is way ahead of what we are thinking about in society, and we really need to find a way of, at a society level, asking, you know, is this particular application acceptable to society in general, or is that one not? You know, and so it's the regulation, and it's also, you know, again, primary care, I think, is the key point.
Well, thank you very much. I'd like to thank, before we clap on all of the people, the volunteer, Rosalind, Dale, Avi, Ella, Barbara, Sheila, Annette, that have worked, especially on our staff, Sarita, Petel, and Bibata, which are helping organizing this, Duncan, which is somewhere helping in the food. I'd like to thank all of you for coming tonight. It was nice. You've been patient, listening, and laughing at some of the bad jokes and the good one. And...
Can I just say something? We will be continuing this debate with the Institute of Cancer Research February the 15th at the Musée des Beaux-Arts in the café. So if you are interested, it will be slightly different, but it is a discussion on personalized medicine. So please feel free to come, and it gives you time to think about more questions.
Absolutely. And we have two more lectures on our site coming in March and in May. And with that, thank you all, the three of you, for coming tonight. It was wonderful follow-up and a good team.
Can I?
Just a second, one last thing in the back.
One last thing. We really would like to hear your opinion and your comments. So if you would please fill out your questionnaires, and we'll collect them going out the door.
Thank you very much. Well
Thanks
said.
For coming.
Good night. Good evening.